Please be aware the stories, theories, reenactments, and language in this podcast are of an adult nature and can be considered disturbing, frightening, and even in some cases, offensive. Listener discretion is therefore advised. Hey, there's very adult content ahead, and you have been warned. Welcome, heathens. Welcome to the world of the weird and unexplained. I'm your host, Nicole Delacroix, and together we will be investigating stories about the weird, wonderful, unexplained, eerie, scary, and downright unbelievable. There will be tales of ghosts, murder, supernatural beings, and unexplained mysteries. So, sit back, grab your favorite drink, relax, and prepare to be transported to today's Dark Enigma. And on today's Dark Enigma, we're going to be exploring those claims of the devil made me do it. Yes. Push the blame off on the devil where it belongs. But is it really a devil that makes us do it? Or are we just bad? Well, I know I'm just bad. As always, we will be playing our drinking game, but only for those of you that are at home and have, well, nowhere else to go tonight. As usual, there is a theme. The devil and all things devilish. I found a few drinks for those of you brave enough to face your demons, and there will be a link. And for those of you, well, not so brave enough, you can still play the game. You can stick to tequila because, well, after all, it is the devil's drink of choice. Now for the business end. Every time I say devil, demonic, or demon, that's going to be a single shot. And every time I say psychiatrist or psychology or something along that lines, it'll be a double shot. Now that we have the business end out of the way, we can jump headfirst into today's Dark Enigma. Every October, grocery stores beef up their candy displays and thrill seekers go searching for the scariest movie, creepiest haunted house, or spookiest ghost story. Devil indeed. Horror movies about the devil and his minions, claiming to be inspired by actual events, usually fly off the shelves as Halloween approaches us. Although such real-life claims of demonic possession may be a touch more believable during this season of thrills and chills, during the rest of the year, most people have a hard time believing evil spirits can cause criminal behavior. This begs the question. Once the body count is totaled, an arrest is made, and the evidence is collected, can a claim of the devil made me do it ever act as a defense? Well, today we're going to be looking at some historical claims of the devil made me do it, and then, after our break, we're going to look at an actual court case that used that very defense. So, let's start in the most obvious of places, Salem, Massachusetts, and the case of Dorothy Talby and the devil in Salem. Nope, it's not the devil went down to Georgia. This time the devil's in Massachusetts. Satan seems to have reared his ugly horned head early in the development of American criminal jurisprudence. In 1638, the Massachusetts Bay Colony hanged Dorothy Talby for murdering her 3-year-old daughter, Difficult Talby, at the devil's direction. First of all, she should have been hung just for naming her child Difficult, because that's a little bit obvious. Anyways, Puritan Governor John Winthrop recorded the facts of the sad tale, which predates the Salem witch trials by a good 50 years, in his personal journal. And I quote, "Talby had been a member of the Church of Salem, and of good esteem for godliness, etc. But, falling at difference with her husband, through melancholy and spiritual delusions, she sometimes attempted to kill him and her children, and herself, by refusing meat and saying it was so revealed to her. After much patience, the church cast her out, but soon after she was so possessed with Satan that he persuaded her by her delusions, which she listened to as revelations from God, to break the neck of her own child, that she might free it from future misery." Yeah, that's pretty interesting, right? At trial, the court determined that although Miss Talby thought she was hearing the voice of God, she actually killed her daughter while possessed by the devil. As American common law governed, which was pretty much based on English common law, and largely influenced by, you guessed it, the Bible and the church, death was the only allowable punishment for the murder of Difficult Talby. As insanity and mental illness were not considered mitigating factors for criminal behavior at that time, even if the Puritan court had found her to be insane, well, the punishment would have been the same, so really she didn't have a chance in hell. Pun intended. Although Miss Talby never repented for her crime, she went to the gallows very unwillingly, because, you know, if you're going to get hung, you better make them fight for that shit, right? Her hanging may be one of many early American executions of the mentally ill. Well, not that much has changed in that regard, but our next story, well, the devil may not have made him do it, but they did make him plead insanity. That's right, the insanity defense did not come into being until more than 200 years later in the 1843 British murder case of Daniel M. Naughton, who was found not guilty by reason of insanity. Alas, no demons were involved. Daniel McNaughton believed Prime Minister Sir Robert Peel was conspiring against him, because, you know, that's what the government does. In 1843, in London, he shot and killed the secretary to the British Prime Minister, but, you know, he actually meant to kill the Prime Minister, so, you know, he missed, I guess. McNaughton was tried and acquitted by reason of insanity and sentenced to spend his life confined in Bedlam, the first mental asylum in Europe. Due to public outcry over his acquittal, the McNaughton rule was established by the House of Lords, which stated if a person charged with a crime was unable to distinguish right from wrong while in the act of committing that crime, he can plead the insanity defense and prove he was not sane at the time. The McNaughton rule was the standard method of determining a person's sanity in the eyes of the law for more than 100 years. Until, well, John Hinckley Jr. attempted to assassinate now former President Reagan to impress actress Jodie Foster. Now, insanity is an affirmative defense, which, rather than claiming the defendant didn't commit the crime, it attempts to excuse the defendant's behavior based on the fact that the defendant was insane at the time the crime was committed. The theory is the defendant did not have the requisite intent to commit a crime because they either did not understand the act was wrong, or, even if they did, they could not control their behavior. Doesn't that mean that all crime is insanity? Okay. Therefore, if the punishment is to fit the crime, insane individuals should be sent to a mental health facility where they can receive care rather than to prison, which is unlikely to deter future antisocial conduct in such cases. Today, insanity pleas are rarely used, and even more rarely successful, as the required standard of proof is, well, incredibly high. Additionally, an insanity plea can only be made with the defendant's consent, and the defendant may refuse the defense so long as the rejection is intelligently and voluntarily made. The standard for proving legal insanity also differs from state to state, and even some states banning the defense entirely. All right, let's move on. On to the most famous devil-made-me-do-it case of all time, Ronald DeFeo Jr. Because DeFeo may have pulled the trigger, but the devil's black hands gave him the gun. So, the devil made him do it. Few houses in the United States are as iconic and easily identifiable as the Amityville House of Horror. Many have read or seen the various books and movies about the alleged paranormal activity at 112 Ocean Avenue. Few are aware, however, of the criminal trial following the grisly murders of 6 members of the DeFeo family that occurred there. These murders would set the stage for one of America's most infamous claims of the devil made me do it. On November 13, 1974, Ronald DeFeo Jr. shot and killed his mother, father, and 4 siblings while they slept in the family home. During his trial, DeFeo claimed that although he murdered his family, he wasn't alone that night. As part of his insanity defense, he claimed he'd heard voices telling him to kill, and that something outside of his control had made him do it. He also stated that a figure with black hands handed him a rifle and followed him throughout the house as he killed his family. In what many critics have suggested was an attempt to shore up his insanity plea, DeFeo also claimed that he believed the voices he heard were messages from God, and alternatively, that he actually was God, because, you know, most guys think they're God anyway. Anyways, despite his testimony, the jury did not believe that DeFeo was insane and instead found him guilty. Since his conviction, DeFeo has recanted much of his previous testimony, saying that he lied in an attempt to create a better insanity plea. He is currently serving 6 life sentences in a New York prison, 1 for each of his murdered family members. Well, we move from 1976 to 1977, where a killer stalked the streets of New York. Seriously, what's going on with New York, you guys? What's up with that? Anyways, our killer stalked the streets of New York, taunting law enforcement and the media with claims that he was, among other things, Beelzebub, Mr. Monster, and the Son of Sam. When the police finally caught David Berkowitz, also known as Son of Sam, 6 women were dead and 7 others had been wounded. Interestingly, when asked why he committed the murders, Berkowitz claimed that although he pulled the trigger, he was acting under the orders of something else. Not someone else, something else. That something was Harvey, a neighbor's black Labrador that Berkowitz believed was possessed by an ancient evil which constantly cried out for blood and death. After his capture, the New York police searched Berkowitz's apartment, finding phrases like, "In this hole lives the wicked king," and "Kill for my master," scrawled upon the walls. Perhaps even creepier were Berkowitz's admissions concerning his attempts to kill the possessed dog. In order to break its hold over him, he threw a Molotov cocktail at it and finally shot it. The dog, however, survived all attempts on its life, helping Berkowitz to believe the animal was protected by supernatural forces. Or maybe he's an idiot and he just can't aim. Either or. Experts disagreed on whether Berkowitz was competent to stand trial for the murders he had committed. Psychiatrists for the defense diagnosed him as a paranoid schizophrenic. They believed that Berkowitz's difficulties relating to people had caused him to be a loner, and that this isolation had provided a breeding ground for his demonic fantasies. Eventually, these fantasies crowded out reality, causing Berkowitz to live in a world full of demons. But the defense psychiatrist noted that his mental condition was improving with treatment. Okay, because maybe they're not all demons. Maybe one or two of them, I don't know, could possibly live. The prosecution psychiatrist, however, was unimpressed, concluding that Berkowitz's demons were a conscious invention he was able to control, not a psychotic disorder which controlled his actions. The presiding judge found Berkowitz to be mentally competent to stand trial, and, well, he was found guilty of murder and sentenced to, you guessed it, 365 years in prison. While serving his sentence, Berkowitz, who was born and raised in the Jewish faith, converted to Christianity. According to New York Magazine writer Steve Fishman, who interviewed Berkowitz in 2006, he now works as a pastor, walking the prison halls with a Gideon Bible and a calling from God. He's battling Satan, he says, his old friend. And David is sure Satan's afraid of him because David knows all his tricks. While some consider this a ploy to get out of prison, it's highly unlikely that Berkowitz would ever be free again. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe he passed away just recently. But I could be wrong on that. Alright, guys, so we're going to take a little break here. And don't forget, idle hands are the devil's playground. So make sure that you join us after the break. And welcome back, my heathens, you little devils. I'm so glad you're still with me. For the rest of the show, we're going to be focusing on an actual case of The Devil Made Me Do It, and how that case played out in a U.S. court. We're talking about the 1981 murder case of Arnie Johnson. That's right, The Devil Made Me Do It. This has long been the plea of those who have been caught doing something wicked that is uncharacteristic of their usual behavior. Most of the time, we take it only as a figure of speech to brush off an aberrant deviation from the norm. However, sometimes the meaning can become all too literal. In 1981, a brutal murder occurred in a tranquil town on the east coast of the United States. A vicious crime that the perpetrator claimed was not carried out by his own hand, but rather that of demons that had taken him over. It was a defense that would carry over into an actual court of law to become the nation's first case of a court defense seeking to blame a crime on demonic possession. And it would trigger a media blitz of this spectacular tale of menacing supernatural evil on trial. The whole strange tale begins in the quite affluent and peaceful neighborhood of Brookfield, Connecticut, where an unassuming family, the Glatzels, had arrived in order to clean and put in order a rental property they had recently acquired in this scenic town of roughly 13,000. Shortly after they arrived, a series of bizarre events began to unfurl that would mark the beginning of the madness that was about to spiral out of control. One day, about a month after they had arrived, Miss Judy Glatzel reported that her youngest son, 11-year-old David, had suddenly and inexplicably fallen down, rather forcefully, onto the bed as if he had been shoved. When questioned about the occurrence later, David told his mother that he had in fact been pushed by what he described as an old man with burnt-looking skin, who had pointed a finger at him and growled the word, "Beware," before throwing him onto the bed. It was a strange story, to be sure, and at first the Glatzels wrote it off as the overactive imagination of a young boy. But David had always been a very honest boy, and his situation was about to get progressively worse. He began to wake up at all hours of the night, sobbing uncontrollably, and when asked what had happened, he would describe how he was being visited in the darkness by an old man with soulless black eyes, animalistic features, sharp, jagged teeth, pointed ears, and hooves. I'm just going to say why he didn't have some jingle bells, but, you know, that's just me. Anyways, David claimed that the intimidating entity was continuously warning him that if they moved into the rental house, they would be harmed. These visitations continued and before long were even occurring in the daytime, when David claimed the beast took on the appearance of an old man with a white beard dressed in a flannel shirt and jeans. 'Cause, you know, he's stylish. David said that sometimes the apparition would snarl in some foreign language or threaten to steal his soul. The spooky visitations also began to be accompanied by various unexplained phenomena throughout the house, such as inexplicable footsteps, slamming doors, and disembodied voices. The weirdness, well, it just wouldn't end there. Nope. David began to exhibit strange wounds, such as scratches, cuts, and bruises on his body, for no discernible reason. And his night terrors gradually worsened to the point that he would wake up howling in terror practically every single night. The mother even claimed to, at one point, have seen her son being choked by unseen hands or flopping about on his bed like a rag doll. David had also put on a large amount of weight in a very short period of time, allegedly becoming extremely fat and putting on 60 pounds in only a few months. So, did he have a Wii or a PlayStation? No, I'm sorry. Too early for that. In light of the strange, seemingly paranormal events that were unfolding around them, the alarmed Glatzels took notice and became convinced that this was not a simple case of their kid trying to get out of household chores or school. They enlisted the assistance of a local Catholic priest from St. Joseph Roman Catholic Church in Brookfield for guidance. The priest performed a ritual cleansing of the house, but it seemed to have no effect as the ominous phenomena continued. The increasingly desperate family pleaded with the church for help, and they were referred to two demonologists and exorcists that you might know by the name of Ed and Lorraine Warren. The Warrens' arrival seemed to mark an increase in bizarre events and aberrant behavior on the part of David. He began to have sudden seizures and fits or convulsions that required him to be restrained at times. He also would occasionally snarl, hiss, or spit at people, and it got to the point where one person was always awake as David slept, in case he should experience one of his bizarre tantrums or seizures. The boy was also known to suddenly begin quoting passages from the Bible and Milton's Paradise Lost, or speaking in voices that were not his own. It was even reported that he would speak passages in Latin, a language with which he had no experience. Lorraine Warren, a self-professed psychic, would later report that on at least one occasion, she had seen a strange black mist congeal next to David. The boy also continued to repeatedly complain of being hit, shoved, or choked by unseen hands. After some time, these escalating bizarre events, the Warrens came to the conclusion that there was a malevolent presence in the house, and that David was most likely subject to multiple possessions, because, you know, that's what happens. Now, it was around this time that the Glatzels' 26-year-old daughter, Deborah, implored her fiancé, Arnie Cheyenne Johnson, to move in with them in order to make them feel safer. In light of what they saw as demonic possession, the Warrens went about conducting a series of exorcisms in an effort to rid the boy of whatever malignant entities were residing within him. Three exorcisms involving the help of no fewer than four Catholic priests were conducted, during which time David would growl, snarl, curse, spit, kick, and scratch like a madman, all to no ultimate effect. The Warrens also claimed that during the exorcisms, David would cease breathing for long periods of time, do rapid series of sit-ups despite his obesity, contort his body into unnatural positions normally not possible, and even levitate. So, I guess he was possessed by the demon of overeating and the demon of working out too much. That would be cool. Okay. I'm sorry, I'm being silly. Eventually, the exorcist learned that there were 43 demons supposedly residing within David. When they asked him who was there during one of his episodes, the boy gave 43 different names. I personally think that I have multiple personalities as well, but not 43 of them. None of them have names. They're just different personalities. Okay, back to our story. The exorcisms did not seem to be having any effect, and the evil presence within David garnered the nicknames The Beast and The Master. The family contacted Brookfield Police in October of 1980 to report that they felt the situation was becoming dangerous and that the boy posed a potential threat, but at the time, they were largely ignored. Debbie's fiancé, Arnie Johnson, was becoming exhausted by the whole ordeal and started taunting the demons that were tormenting David. He is said to have shouted at them on several occasions and to have challenged and commanded them to enter him instead. Johnson was reported to have reportedly said on numerous occasions, "Come into me, leave the little lad alone." I don't know anybody who says lad other than Scottish people and Irish people, so that was weird. And yes, there's a joke in there about the come into me, but we're not going to go there, guys. During one of these times, he became terrified when he claimed to have seen the demons and even made eye contact with them as he looked into David's eyes, something the Warrens had strictly warned him not to ever do. Not long after this, Johnson crashed his car into a tree, and while he was unharmed in the accident, he would later claim that the demons had taken control of him and caused him to crash, because I know when I get into a car accident, that's what I claim too. In November of 1980, Judy and Carl Glatzel took their son to a psychiatrist to see if there was anything that could be done to help the increasingly disturbed boy, or if any answers for his condition could be gleaned from the scientific community. Why they didn't do this first, I don't know, but this is where we go. The psychiatrist informed the family that David was normal, exhibiting only a minor learning disability, certainly nothing to account for his escalating bizarre behavior. Nevertheless, they enrolled their son in a special school for disturbed children, hoping that this would somehow cure him after all else had failed. Because that's how it works. You know, your kid starts acting crazy, you call in an exorcist and a demonologist, and you go through the exorcism rites, and then you just enroll them in a special school. Okay. Anyways. In the meantime, Debbie and Johnson were moved out of the house. They lived in an apartment near the Brookfield Pet Motel where Debbie had gotten a job as a dog groomer. The manager and owner of the pet motel, as well as the landlord of the apartment, was Alan Bono, who would become friends with the couple. In the ensuing weeks, Debbie Glatzel became increasingly concerned as Johnson started to display strange, uncharacteristic behavior. The normal, polite, and even-tempered Johnson would become highly irritated at the smallest things and would suddenly go into bizarre trances during which he would growl, snarl, or convulse, and which he claimed to have no memory of. During several of these episodes, he would shout out in despair that he could see the beast staring at him, after which he would once again claim he could not remember such a thing happening. These weird trances became more frequent and his behavior more erratic, until Debbie started to fear that perhaps her fiancé had been possessed by the same demons that had inhabited her brother, despite the fact that none of Johnson's co-workers reported anything out of the ordinary, once again proving that women will stay with your crazy ass no matter what. On February 16th, 1981, tragedy struck. Johnson called in sick to his job. Oh, that's a tragedy. No, I'm just kidding. As a tree surgeon, and joined Debbie and Bono for a lunch party, during which they all reportedly drank heavily. After the party, they returned to the apartment to hang out, and at some point during the conversation, Johnson and Bono got into a heated argument. During the confrontation, Johnson allegedly went into one of his trances, after which he started growling like an animal and pulled out a folding 5-inch knife and proceeded to viciously and repeatedly stab Bono, who would die at a hospital from his wounds several hours later. Johnson, who had no previous criminal record of any kind, had fled the scene and was apprehended several miles from the scene of the crime and charged with first-degree murder. He claimed at the time that he could not remember anything of the incident. The case was already exceptional, as it was the first murder ever recorded in the history of Brookfield. I'm just going to point out, 1981, and that was the first murder they ever had? Kudos to you, Brookfield. Kudos. But things, they were about to take a turn for the bizarre rather quickly. A mere day after the murder, Lorraine Warren made the claim that Johnson had been possessed by demons when the murder was committed, and that David Glatzel had said he had seen the demons go from him into Johnson's body. This was further given fuel when the family supported these claims, saying that the murder had been the devil's work, and that the beast had transferred to Johnson's body during the exorcism when he had taunted them to do so. These claims of demonic possession and murder in this quiet, sleepy town drove the media into a frenzy, and the story was covered extensively in various outlets. Yes, this was before the internet, people. We actually watched the news. I don't know, because I wasn't alive at that time, but whatever. Making the whole affair even more mysterious was that although the Glatzels and Warrens talked about the exorcism that had been conducted on David, the church itself went through great lengths to distance itself from these claims. The diocese officially stated that although a Father Vergilock and three other priests had indeed been involved in helping the boy through his affliction, it adamantly denied that any actual exorcisms had been performed. The spokesman for the diocese, Reverend Nicholas Greco, explained that the bishop's approval would have been required to carry out an exorcism and that no such approval had ever even been sought. This sat squarely opposite from what the Glatzels and Warrens were saying, as they claimed that such approval in fact had been granted after two of the younger priests had approached the bishop personally. Making matters more complicated was that none of the priests who had allegedly been directly involved in the exorcisms were permitted to comment on the incident to reporters or investigators, and all of them were mysteriously transferred to other parishes. Things would get even more bizarre. When Johnson's trial came, his defense attorney, Martin Minella, decided to use the alleged demonic possession as an actual legal defense for his client. Because, after all, the devil made us do it, right? It would be the first time in U.S. history in which the defense sought to prove innocence by arguing demonic possession, and therefore a lack of personal responsibility. Because, after all, we have no personal responsibility in anything we do, right? Media attention to the case reached a fever pitch, and the trial came to be known as the Demon Murder Trial and the Devil Made Me Do It Trial. Attorney Minella, for his part, extensively researched the feasibility of such an argument and found that such a defense was not unprecedented in the world. Minella put forth two cases from England in which the defense of possession had been allowed. One in which an arsonist was acquitted on grounds of demonic possession, and another in which a rapist had received a suspended sentence for the same reason. The lawyer even made arrangements to have exorcists from Europe flown in for the trial. In addition, he was prepared to subpoena the priest that had allegedly performed the exorcism on David Glatzel if they didn't cooperate. Minella vowed, and I quote, "I'm going to show the guy isn't insane and that it's not a delusion. The courts have dealt with the existence of God, and now they'll be asked to deal with the existence of the demonic spirit," end quote. I kind of agree with him. You know what? If you're going to say there's a God, you have to say there's a devil. It's easy. The trial commenced on October 28, 1981, at Connecticut Superior Court in Danbury. As expected, Minella entered a plea of innocence on the grounds that his client had been possessed by demons that had passed into him from David, and as such had not been in control of himself, therefore releasing him from the responsibility of any wrongdoing. During the proceedings, alleged taped evidence of the priest confirming approval for an exorcism was presented, as well as lurid photographs depicting scenes such as Johnson kneeling over David on the floor with a crucifix pressed to his forehead, and another in which Johnson is holding the boy down as the crucifix lies broken on the floor next to him. Despite this, presiding judge Robert Callahan was not convinced, and he disallowed this argument, stating that none of it could be objectively or scientifically verified through the available evidence. As a result, all of the testimony related to the demonic possession defense was thrown out. The jury was not permitted to consider it as a viable reason for the murder, and Minella was forced to change his tactic, changing his stance to that of self-defense. After 3 days of deliberations, the jury came to the conclusion that Johnson was guilty of first-degree manslaughter, and he was sentenced to 10 to 20 years in prison, of which he would ultimately serve only 5. That's right, sentenced to 20 years, serve only 5. The U.S. justice system at work. In the aftermath of the trial, media interest in the case waned, but the story was not over yet. In 1983, Lorraine Warren helped Gerald Brittle write a book about the incident titled The Devil in Connecticut, which many saw as a cheap attempt to make a profit off of the Glatzel family's suffering. But Warren insisted that proceeds from the book would be donated to the family. The book was re-released in 2006, by which time David Glatzel, now an adult, and his brother Carl Glatzel Jr. sued the publisher on the grounds that they claimed it gave the family emotional distress, violated their privacy, and contained a good amount of libel. Carl further said that the Warrens had lied about the events that had taken place and that the exorcism story was a hoax, a tall tale they had weaved to take advantage of and make profit off of David's mental illness. Carl also complained that the book had made him out to be the villain of the story because he had never subscribed to the supernatural explanations of what had happened. For their part, the Warrens have stuck to their versions of events. Lorraine Warren has repeatedly insisted that the supernatural phenomena that occurred was real and that all of the priests involved had agreed that the boy had been possessed by demons. Additionally, Debbie Glatzel and Arnie Cheyenne Johnson, to this day, continue to assert that the Warren's version of the events is true, further saying that the Glatzel family is suing purely for monetary gain. By the way, Arnie and Debbie, happily married. The priests involved with the supposed exorcism have never come forward to officially support either side of the story and continue to remain silent on the matter. So, what do we make of this story? Did the devil, in fact, really make Johnson do it? Considering the myriad versions of the events and the conflicting claims of all involved, it's really kind of difficult to say. However, is there the potential that some dark force can compel a rational person to commit evil deeds that they would never imagine committing otherwise? And if so, should they be held accountable for it? Or is this all just some wicked element of the human soul which occasionally bubbles and froths forth from some murky recesses of our psyche to drive us to these atrocities? And in the end, it's only us to blame for failing to be the gatekeeper that keeps the beast from getting out. Law has always had to deal with the fine line between sanity and insanity, accountability and absolution. Is there perhaps another line on which we teeter? The line between the deeds of our own mind and those of something other, maybe? It's unlikely that the defense tried during the Arne Cheyenne Johnson trial will ever be admissible in court, but it can perhaps cause us to reflect upon the nature of an evil that potentially resides within every single one of us, supernatural or not. That's right, there is a classic study in social psychology that asked criminals and non-criminals alike if they would commit certain crimes if they knew 100% that they would never get caught. The criminals' responses did not differ from the responses of non-criminals. This suggests that all people, criminal or not, have roughly the same desire to commit crimes. The only thing separating them is a fear of, or at least a consideration of, getting caught. And I wonder if this same idea is at play when it comes to hell. Do people avoid cheating, murdering, raping, and stealing, and whatnot, because they want to avoid the punishment of hell? Non-criminals presumably don't do criminal acts because they are more aware of, or perhaps more scared of, punishment than criminals. But the desire to commit crimes is roughly the same. And it appears the same type of issue is at play when it comes to immoral actions and belief in God or a higher power. If a retaliatory God, most notably Satan, is on one's mind, then people behave more morally, presumably because they are afraid of punishment. Maybe our intentions for doing good, well, maybe they're not as virtuous as we often assume they are. So that begs to question, was the devil's greatest trick making us believe that he doesn't really exist? Good and evil may exist on earth, but when it comes to proving their agents affect human behavior, happy endings are more easily found preceding movie credits than they are following jury verdicts. In 350 years, the American legal system has evolved from a colonial practice of seeing Satan behind the evil, but punishing the defendant nonetheless, to a modern belief that people are responsible for their own actions. The insanity defense is a narrow exception to this rule, and judges and juries are wary of those who attempt to avoid punishment by acting first and pleading insanity later. Although an insanity defense and a prolonged stay in a mental institution may seem like a better alternative to a lengthy or lifelong prison sentence, when trying to meet the burden of proof, always remember that with the insanity defense, well, the devil is in the details. Maybe it's just like prolific country music star from my own home state of Texas, Billy Joe Shaver, says, "The devil made me do it the first time. The second time, well, I done it on my own." And with that, my lovelies, we've come to the end of our episode, and I thank you for joining us. And we do hope that you do take some time to reach out to us. You know, the devil made you do it. And share your thoughts on what you think happened. You can reach the show at darkenigmapodcast@gmail.com. And hey, if you have suggestions for any future shows, or if you just want to tell me what you think, drop me a line. On that note, that's all the time we have for today, and thank you for joining us here on Renegade Talk Radio. And don't forget, tune in next time, and keep it spooky, people.
We don't sugarcoat shit. This is Renegade Talk Radio. Renegade Talk Radio.